Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast reflecting on its poor life choices. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
In this midweek shot, we are going to reflect on our picks of our movers and shakers of 2019. What did we get right and what did we get wrong? Know at the start of every year we pick the leader, shadow minister, shadow cabinet minister, etc., etc., who we think will make waves in the British political landscape. Usually we try and check in on those picks throughout the year. We didn't check in on the picks throughout 2019 because 2019 was a bit of a roller coaster year. There was too much Brexit news going on to actually take a step back.
Yeah, there was never really any lull for which we went, okay, let's take a breather here and try and take in where we are. It was just constantly on from one thing to the next, even though so much of it was just, no, we haven't actually changed anything in Brexit. It's still the same problems as before.
But we are in the post-Christmas hub in the bunker. The roast turkey we were eating has finally all been consumed. Turkey rissoles, turns out. Not as tasty as you'd expect. So now we have a time to reflect with a glass of mulled wine. The leaders we picked, you picked Nicola Sturgeon and I picked Jeremy Corbyn. Now, the reason you picked Nicola Sturgeon, Steve, was because you said if there was going to be a push for a people's vote. Do you remember the people's vote campaign?
I do remember the people's vote campaign.
Yeah, whatever happened to those guys? Or if there's going to be an election, it would be because the SNP was going to push for it, which I believe counts as a correct prediction.
Savour it, listeners. It is probably one of a few.
And I picked Jeremy Corbyn in more than hope than expectation he might make the political weather. I suppose if one was being cynical or provocative, one could argue he made the political weather,
just not in the way we wanted.
Obviously, at the start of 2019, Labour hadn't come out in favour of another referendum. And the problem with Labour shenanigans throughout all of last year and the previous year meant that it wasn't really the Brexit policy that was the problem in the election. It was more the convoluted, tortured steps to get there, which meant that all the Remainers thought that Labour was a Leave party and all the Leavers thought Labour was a Remain party. So that's a check for you. I suppose the fact we didn't pick the then Prime Minister shows that already by January, everyone knew Theresa May's time was up. I don't think we quite thought she'd go as quickly as she did.
No, but we knew she was a lame duck at that point.
Mm. And so instead, we had half an eye when we picked our ministers on the race to succeed Theresa May. And your pick was Sajid Javid, or as we should call him, the Saj, who at that time was bookie's favourite to be the next Tory leader. I picked Amber Rudd as my minister, who's no longer an MP. So obviously this is another pick of yours. your mover and shaker moved and shook better than mine did, I feel.
But that said, I think Javid did indeed move and he did indeed shake, but not necessarily to any great amount. Yes, he has become the Chancellor of the Exchequer, but actually, as you said, he was previously thought of as being a serious candidate for the next Tory leader, and whilst he ran for the leadership, he was effectively an also-ran right from the get-go. He never really found any footing, never really got anywhere with anything during the leadership campaign. So he moved and he shook, but not to any great effect. So I can theoretically claim a point in that he climbed up the greasy rungs of power, but I don't necessarily think he actually has done much.
I mean, his leadership campaign, he was one of the few, I feel, in that leadership race who actually, I felt better about them as a person at the end of that leadership campaign than I did at the end. There was a nice video with him and his dog. Remember his dog?
I do remember that.
And he also got the other leadership candidates in that televised debate to sign up to an inquiry into Islamophobia in the Tory party,
which Boris Johnson has since completely kiboshed.
Right.
Or rather, he's put it into a wider inquiry into racism, which sounds like something he's criticised, or people criticised Jeremy Corbyn for. in the past, just replacing Islamophobia with anti-Semitism.
They could just get Shami Chakrabarti to write a report.
We need to do... Well, because they can't give her a peerage now, so...
They could just give her Wessex or something.
It's true.
Some sort of estate.
Make her a duchess.
Yeah, because in that first episode, I said I thought we'd reached peak Javid. I feel like now we have reached peak Javid. Yes, he's Chancellor, another one of the great offices of state, but feels like he's been slightly marginalised in that role. That's certainly the impression you get from the various tittle-tattle.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just largely the fact that we haven't done anything apart from Brexit and for so very, very long that the Chancellor of Exchequer just doesn't necessarily feel like it is the great office of state that it is. I suspect, potentially, as we move forward and if the government can move on to things that aren't Brexit-related, perhaps Javid Starr starts to rise again, but I think you're right and we've reached the peak of Javid's career. Right, okay, here.
So I'm looking forward to... When we take back all that sovereignty, I imagine all the policy announcements will just run.
Absolutely.
So my pick of Amber Rudd, and again, maybe it's a bit like the 2019 election, you could say. It's not that your pick was amazing, it's that my pick kind of fell apart a little bit. Amber Rudd, just as I think our pick for influential backbenchers, so you picked Dominic Grieve, I picked Yvette Cooper. I think, certainly on my part... One of the issues, I think, or one of the errors I've made in the 3 years of podcasting is assuming at some point a compromise for a soft Brexit will be found and that the Remainer Tories would get their acts together and actually deliver some sort of workable compromise that wasn't the hard Brexit that May's deal, or now Johnson's deal, is. I assumed that Rudd and Grieve and Cooper would find majority in the House of Commons for something. And that didn't happen.
To be honest, it's very much a case of we massively overestimated, I think, the ability of, in effect, the Remainers in Parliament to play ball with each other and play nice and actually want to focus on this one specific goal of stopping the government rather than trying to play politics with the wider issue, which is what ended up happening, where both the Lib Dems, Labour and the SNP at various points, or at some of the various indicative votes and things that happened, prevented a deal from getting over the line, or a deal that was not the government's deal getting over the line as a concept. Yeah, I think this was very much a failure of politics.
I think there are two moments we can look back on. I think one of them is the indicative votes, as you say, which I think was crucial. I'd forgotten that I could be really angry. I thought I was now chipper and could kind of smile through the pain, but I was really angry once it turned out that all the soft Brexit options had failed, mainly because of Lib Dems and Labour Remainers voting against or not voting for Norway options, or yeah. Ken Clark's customs union. I think that will definitely be seen as the moment in which a soft Brexit compromise was never going to be...
feasible.
No. I mean, the original sin, as Tim Farron might say, was, I think, Theresa May. I think we can't say that enough, that if she had shown some leadership and statesmanship on becoming Prime Minister and tried to work with the opposition, we would also be in a far better place as a country. And she abdicated that to try and get a massive majority for herself and failed.
Yeah.
So there's that moment. I think the other moment is pushing for that snap election. And there's an interesting private eye piece which has done the rounds on Twitter of Best for Britain, which is one of the pro-EU campaigning organisations. They did an MRP poll that suggested there was going to be a big Tory majority if Farage basically backed Johnson and his deal. It sounds like essentially Joe Swinson's team ignored it because they assumed they were going to win 100 seats.
Well, the piece suggests that they had some alternative data which suggested a very different result. As it turns out, their data was not accurate. And so more for the Lib Dems on that, but equally more for Labour for also being shown this exact same set of data and assuming that actually in 2019 the election would follow the exact same course as 2017, where we would see a rise in the Labour vote just by virtue of people deciding they liked Corbyn, which when clearly we can see that actually, with the power of hindsight, 2017 was not about the success of Corbynism, it was about the failure of the Conservative Party's campaign and the fact that everything went horribly, horribly wrong and Labour didn't screw anything up.
Well, no, and I think also that a lot of Remain voters did vote Labour to stop a Theresa May Brexit, which I don't think was appreciated enough at the time.
Yeah.
And it was assumed it was down to Corbyn. I think I did this as well. I think it was assumed it was down to the manifesto.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other stuff was ignored at the time. Again, it's a wider failure of Labour strategy over the past year or two, not just to reach a decent Brexit position, but also you spent 18 months calling for another election rather than a referendum and then got backed into a corner when it was probably obvious that Labour was never going to win that election.
Yeah.
And actually, you think about backbenchers who we could have chosen at the start of 2019, we could have picked Boris Johnson rather than Yvette Cooper, who was probably has made more moving and shaking.
Just a little bit. Becoming Prime Minister is a fairly mover and shakery thing to do.
Talking of becoming Prime Minister, Shadow Ministers, who we've chosen.
Yep.
Keir Starmer, or as we should call him, Steer Karma, I suppose. He was my pick.
Good pick.
And you picked John McDonnell.
Equally good, I think. I think in many ways for slightly different reasons. Like before when we were discussing this, you mentioned like how they were both kind of integral to kind of getting Labour's position on like the second referendum shifted into backing it in some capacity, which I think is accurate. But I think also just by virtue of, let's break it down into the separate things. Starmer, for instance, we can demonstrate with data as of like today or yesterday, as of time of recording, that he's been making some waves because he's currently the front runner in terms of based on the polling for the Labour leadership to be the next leader. It's a very good strong position to be in. That definitely suggests he's made some very positive impressions and he's definitely kind of a made some waves in some capacity. McDonnell, equally, you can say he was most definitely at the heart of the Corbyn operation in various ways, but was also not so attached to it that he wasn't coming out and making his own assessments, coming out with slightly different readings of situations, little things like the fact that after the shocking result of the general election, basically he held up his hands in an interview and said, "Mea culpa, I'm responsible for this." You know, little things like that demonstrated that he actually was an individual of great...
Well, he proved he was a proper politician.
Yeah, he proved he was a proper politician and actually demonstrated some gravitas.
Are there any other people involved in Labour's general election campaign who have shown such similar responsibility for their actions?
Have we fired James Milne out of cannon yet?
No, we haven't, but we should go back to that.
Yeah, given he's getting, what, six figures?
We might as well just put $2,000 a week in a wheelbarrow and burn it. I picked Starmer partly because even at the start of last year, there was a poll that said he was favourite among members to succeed Jeremy Corbyn. So
yeah.
The poll that's come out in the last week isn't an outlier. It fits with the information we already had. The thing with McDonnell, I think, is I reckon any Labour leadership candidate that wins is essentially going to keep the so-called Corbynite economic agenda. Now, the intellectual heavyweight for that, a lot of that is McDonald's done the heavy lifting for that. So when they talk about Corbynism, actually I think what they mean is radical Ed Miliband-ness, but that big policy agenda is McDonald's.
Yeah, I can definitely see McDonnell being the one that people try and court. And I suspect that ultimately the winner will probably have the backing in some form of McDonnell. It may not necessarily be an explicit, "this is my candidate," type of approach, but I do suspect it may be a bit more that there will be a certain level of agreement which will be made between McDonnell and whoever does win. And you can see that even with Starmer currently, where his approach has basically been, "No, the policy agenda was fine, we just failed on messaging, we failed on dealing with anti-Semitism."
For our picks for those outside the big two parties, none of us went for Vince Cable or any of the different personalities of Vince Cable, who was leader of the Lib Dems at that point, mainly because we thought he was a bit rubbish and then was sort of slightly proven wrong when he retired as leader, leading them out on a blaze of glory with loads of extra MEPs and extra MPs and extra councillors. So that was fun. If we'd have had a recap in June, we'd have had a very different conversation, I think.
Yeah, I think Cable did all right. I still don't think he'd have won them any particularly many more seats in the general election, because I don't think he would necessarily have changed the course too differently from where they ended up going.
Well, our picks were, I believe, Arlene Foster and Caroline Lucas. So rather our shadow minister pick, I think it's very much a score draw. I think this is very much a no score draw.
Yeah.
DUP's hold on the Conservatives is no longer by the short and curlies.
And even when Boris Johnson didn't have a majority, it was quite clear they'd been abandoned at the wayside. Johnson didn't care about trying to keep them on board in the same way that that Theresa May did. And they did nothing about it. So, yeah. And Lucas, I think I was kind of working on the assumption that the Greens would be a lot more relevant than they were, especially in relation to any potential general elections and things that came about. And the reality is, relevancy there was none. The Greens vanished into a hole of nothingness.
Well, no, so the only thing that Caroline Lucas really made the headlines for at all was calling, the summer silly season story was she called for a cabinet of women to sort out Brexit.
Yes, I vaguely remember that.
Which caused lots of headlines, but I don't think necessarily led to anything else. I mean, one thing we did call right is we said that there would be a party split in some form in 2019. And there were definitely lots of splits in lots of different forms.
Lots and lots of them.
But I think what I said at the time was I thought the Greens were better placed to exploit any split on the left than the Lib Dems were, which was incorrect. I'm not quite sure how the Greens do get a breakthrough, whether it's, they've got Caroline Lucas, which is great. They've got a few local councillors, especially in Solihull, they've worked really well. They're the opposition party on the council near us. That's an obscure, not quite an obscure Birmingham reference. Our Solihull listeners wouldn't like that. An obscure West Midlands reference. I think it's hard to see how where the Greens progress, where they go from here, really.
Yeah, a lot of the areas that they were trying to target, well, an awful lot of them, like places like Bath, well, those have become solidly Lib Dem again.
Just as Bristol did in 2017, which was another key target seat for theirs, which went very Labour.
I think in the past we've discussed kind of like the influence of like the Green Party and Green and the Green movement and Green parties internationally in kind of shaping the political agenda, with which overall they've been very effective at that because climate change is an issue and people are actually talking about it and people are talking about how we can encourage cycling rather than driving and all of those sorts of things. But I think the fact that we're there. There are very few people who don't think that climate change is an issue in some form. There are many people who don't necessarily agree on the speed at which we need to do something about it, but most people agree on the science and just kind of go and will say, yes, we need to do something about it. So they've won in a lot of ways, and it's a case of, okay, well, what are you for now? If I care about being left-wing, there are lots of other alternatives for that. If I care about the environment now, there are lots of other alternatives for that. So what is the purpose of the Green Party? What do they offer that no one else can at the moment?
I believe it might have been an Owen Jones article that talked about maybe the Greens could almost, a little bit like the Cooperative Party do, essentially not quite merge with Labour, but just as you can have Labour and Cooperative MPs, you can have Labour and Green MPs. And that could be a way of massively increasing
their influence.
Yeah. Again, I mean, that's part of a much wider conversation that needs to be had. Typical arrogant Labour saying, well, we could just co-opt them. we will give you nothing, but we'll take all of your soul. Influential commentators, you picked Aaron Bastani of Navarra Media, and I picked Paul Goodman of Conservative Home. I'm going to call this, mainly because if I don't call this one, I'm not going to have a win at all. This is a win for me. One of the reasons I picked Paul Goodman was because I thought Conservative Home would have a big influence in shaping members' views towards a leadership contest. I think it's fairly safe to say that Paul Goodman had quite a bit of a role in supporting Johnson among Tory members, in defending Johnson's Brexit deal, and the Tories have ended 2019 in a massively stronger position than when they ended it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Goodman is an excellent pick. I don't think there's any denying that. And in many ways, probably the dark horse or the sleeper pick of pretty much any other kind of option we were kind of talking about. Like, Goodman is a name which an awful lot of people would have no clue who he is. But he is a very astute commentator and very, very, very well read, very well written, and very interesting to read as well.
Speaking of which, Aaron Bastani.
Yes, speaking of which, Aaron Bastani. You see, I think that there's a case to be made that he and Navarra Media as a whole were movers and shakers, just not in the way that they wanted to be in terms of the impact. Because I suspect that Navarra Media, being part of that left-wing online bubble and being the kind of almost like the main kind of talking point or kind of place where a lot of people get their talking points within that kind of bubble, has been very influential in shaping politics, but in the way that it ultimately has led to or influenced Labour's loss. There's a big thing about people saying, oh yeah, Twitter is not the country, Twitter is not the country, Twitter is not the country, which is absolutely true. Twitter's a lot more left-wing, people who are on Twitter are more likely to be politically engaged of any description. But Navarra Media have kind of fed into that into that notion that social media can be seen as a sign of success. Social media is a meaningful measurement for politics in some form. And I think the way that they've gone about things has kind of led to the production of content which gets virally shared, which in turn helps reinforce the kind of the media bubble that a lot of online leftists find themselves in, which in turn has created this absolute shock that actually we could possibly lose and that we can't just replicate 2017 like we did. We can't just replicate 2017 like we hoped we could. So I think there's a case to be made that they were influential, just not in a good way from our perspective.
Navarra Media is much more about reflecting a party line and essentially defending the Labour leadership in a way that Paul Grudman, okay, yes, he's a conservative, but it's very much a critical friend, yes. I would say.
Yeah. Goodman, you can show that there is actual thought that goes into pretty much every piece he writes in some form. And as a result of such, he's quite interesting. Same way with Paul Mason. Maybe it's just commentators called Paul.
Paul Mason was my reserve wildcard pick, or my other thought for a commentator pick last year. Almost for a similar reason. And I mean, I don't know, but I wonder if the fact you've got people like Aaron Bastani, who are getting gigs in the mainstream media, seen as kind of sympathetic to Labour, I think played not a massive role. Like, this is, page 68 of the reasons why Labour lost. But you had Tory leaflets that were putting him out on leaflets with ideas and things that he'd said. And so I think it's part of that general maloma. And I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that we need to be more, and I think we'll talk about this in other podcasts, one of the things we need to do as a party in the movement next year is not dismiss information which contradicts our view and dismiss it as biased.
Yeah.
Because for the last year or two, we've seen lots of polls saying that people didn't like our positions, didn't like our leadership, that we weren't going to win an election. And essentially they were ignored because it was almost like the Republican unskewed polls thing from 4 years ago. It was always, well, YouGov's owned by a Tory anyway, or they're all media smears, or this kind of thing. And sometimes you actually need to not like the smell of your own farts.
Sometimes the data is accurate. A lot of the times the data is accurate, and we need to accept that.
Talking of things we need to accept, our wild cards were Emmanuel Macron and Len McCluskey.
Nil-nil draw then.
I said at the time that Macron was a bad pick.
It was a wild card pick.
Yeah, well, just because it's a wild card doesn't mean it has to be bad. if you wanted someone who's going to have more sway on Brexit negotiations, pick Angela Merkel or pick Leo Varadkar. Maybe what Macron, the fact that Macron wasn't such a good pick shows is actually that unity of the EU27 still held.
Yeah.
And that fallacy the British government has had for 3 years, that you can drive wages between the EU27, really hasn't.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but I think my reason behind picking Macron was basically he'd get fed up of us and effectively force our hand in some capacity.
And then do stuff in Calais, basically.
Yeah. But obviously that never happened. Again, I think because I think he was very annoyed. I do think it wouldn't shock me to discover, as we go through the history books, that he was very close to doing something daft. But Merkel, Varadkar, Juncker, whoever, were able to keep him in line, keep him on board, and kind of keep him spinning the party line for the EU. So yeah, I think that unity is the thing, again, something that we didn't quite realise, I think, that would occur.
Some of us did. Sorry. but I can't really gloat because my wild card was Len McCluskey, and I suppose sort of moving, sort of shaking in a
shaking in the sense of old man yells at cloud kind of way, raising his fist into the air.
Yes. That's a kind of bit of a run through what we've got right, what we've got wrong. I'm sure there's other things, but we're going to talk about them on our other posts looking forward to what parties should or should not do in 2020. We have a Patreon page, don't we, Steve?
We do now have a Patreon page, yes.
So you can pay us to make even better predictions or worse predictions. I'll make any prediction for money.
Oh, we should add an option on the Patreon for you give us a pound every time we get a prediction wrong. We'll be millionaires in no time.
What's the website for that?
It's www.patreon.com/notenoughchampagne.
There you go. That's hard to remember. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.